there's 9 things that we go through. First thing we find is that top leading managers are totally committed to building a balanced production team. And what they understand is they want to raise the level of commitment amongst the people within their team. Now, commitment's an interesting thing because nobody is more committed probably to the enterprise than probably we are as the owner or leader, the person who's responsible for the success of it. But what we find is that commitment is a measure of how much pain someone will handle before they quit. How many times will they get frustrated, get anxiety-ridden, get rejected, get beat up before they throw their hands up and say, you know what, I don't need this stuff, I'm out of here. Now, what's interesting is we're all born with an ability to be totally committed. But think about it. Children, right, they're born. They're naturally infants are given this high level of commitment. One of the examples is when they learn to walk, right? About 10 months old, they start to do it. They cruise along the couches, they fall down, they bang their head, they cry a little bit, they pick themselves up, they keep on going, right, until they eventually walk. They don't get up one day, fall down, bang their head, and go, Mom, I'm thinking the stroller might be a better option. See? They don't do that. Yet how many of us have had a salesperson come on board, get all excited, oh, I'm gonna be your top person. Just tell me who your top person is, and I'll be like that person. And within 60 days, they're negative, they're not showing up for meetings, they're not making the sales. It happens all the time because the level of commitment isn't there. And we're gonna look at that today when we talk about motivating a group, because I've learned as a manager that I cannot motivate other people. If I have to on an individual daily basis, there's no way I have the capacity to do that. It's too hard. Motivation's kind of like a bath. You need it every day. And so what I want to create is an organization, an environment within which people can motivate themselves. And that's what we're looking to do. But we've got to be totally committed to building this balanced production team. Now, balanced production is an interesting word. It's probably something we all strive for, but not all of us can grab. I look forward to my organization, probably like you do. Balanced production means you're not dependent on any one salesperson for your monthly sales objectives. You're not dependent on any one salesperson for your monthly sales objectives. But many organizations are built around one or two salespeople. And if that person has a bad month, or if they decide, like most people, it's always easier to run another person's company. And that top salesperson can often become an armchair quarterback. They can sit back and say, well, I do this, I can't believe you're doing that. And they try to run your organization. They're obviously also out there high profile for other companies to try to pick away. So my goal is to build balanced production. How do you do it? Well, you do it through obviously building the territory. One of the mistakes I made years ago is I had a person who was with our organization, and he was incredible. He did an awesome job. He didn't always start out that way. He showed up first day. He was a drummer from a rock and roll band. He's got long hair. And so this gentleman shows up, and we didn't want to bring him on, but one of the managers on my team says, hey, Ron, they'll never see him. He's on the phone. And so we hired this gentleman, and he came on board, and he became just incredibly successful right away. Now, one of the mistakes we made is when other people would leave, there's a concept called orphan adoption. So when a person leaves, you know, where do the accounts go that they were working on? And unfortunately, we made the error of over the years letting all the adopted accounts go to this gentleman. And it was under the concept, put your biggest guns on your biggest targets. Well, at the end of 2 or 3 years, he owned all the key accounts within the company. And anybody else who came on board felt like, how could I ever succeed? Because this guy owns all the opportunity. And so we had a problem with that recruiting. And then he got picked off. He got taken away from me by one of the competitive speakers. And the accounts pretty much stay with the company because they followed Tom Hopkins. But it created a real challenge as a leader. So what I've learned now is we divide our accounts by, you know, in our case, vertical industry. You could do it by geography, however you do that. But as people leave, those accounts get evenly managed. So you've got to manage the territory, and you've got to try to build up the opportunity so people feel like there's balanced production. Don't let one or two people, dominate the whole thing. But as much as possible, create that. You also want to think about the word team. This is something that is a small thing, but it makes a big difference, is try to avoid things like my people. They're not really my people. My team members. They don't work for me, they work with me. In fact, in many cases, I feel like I work for them. But it's a big difference. And when leaders and owners of companies talk about sales team members as my people, my possessions, my things working for me, it doesn't build towards this team concept. You want to create this environment where we're together trying to accomplish the goal. So that's the first thing we find top leaders do. Number two is they develop personal discipline, they live what they teach, and they command respect. And this is a key thing for, obviously, leaders. Now, most of us grew up in the sales field. We were good at it, so now we're asked to become leaders. So it's pretty natural that many of us would like to go back and sell more. I know I would. I mean, that's kind of a fun thing. You've got to stay active in that. Probably the best way to do it is spending time in the field with your team members. I use a concept I call the ride-along. You would probably go out and see some sales calls. But I, you know what's interesting? I learn more behind the windshield of a car with my sales team members than I'll ever learn in the boardroom. And just between running around and doing appointments. Now, here's what I get from that is I get to learn what they're going through. I get to spend time with them, but I also get to see what the customers are going through. So as much as possible, you want to spend time interacting with your customers, with your salespeople, not just with your customers. Here's an interesting example. A gentleman by the name of John Cook founded a company several years ago called the Boston Beer Company. Anyone know the brand name that's popular? Sam Adams, probably if you like beer, probably one of the great beer. In fact, it was a microbrewery. Now it's probably not so much anymore, but they're coming out with Sam Adams Light now. I can't believe it. That's taking all the, but so the Sam Adams, John Cook spends 2 days every week with the drivers of the trucks. So he goes out and he drives. Now he started doing that back in the 80s because he wanted to stay in touch with the customers. He wanted to be at ground level in the trenches. But here's what he found as a side benefit. Is his goal was not to necessarily hang with his drivers who are also route salespeople, but it was with the customers. But what he found was he got to learn from his salespeople. And his sales team members had tremendous respect because every week this guy would spend 2 days riding in the trucks and he was right on things. If there were challenges, he was willing to own up to them. He could see from an early advantage point as well as a frontline opportunity what was going on. And he spent time with his sales team. You know what's interesting about John Cook today, and it's been 20 years, that company is extremely successful. They make millions of dollars, and there is no reason that John Cook would have to ride with the salespeople anymore because he could hire a sales manager to do that, couldn't he? Easily. He could hire hundreds of them because he has that kind of capital. But what does John Cook do every week? 2 days with the drivers. Still today. Still. And that's what I would encourage. As an owner of my company, we've had sales managers over the years manage our inside and our outside team. I manage an inside phone operation and as well as a field operation. And I always try to go, and just 3 weeks ago, I was up in Salt Lake. I spent 3 days riding with my sales team. I was in Dallas, Texas 4 weeks ago doing the same thing. Riding out, going out in sales appointments, watching what they're doing, trying to help them, but spend time with the customers. But what I found was is, in between the appointments in the car, I gained all kinds of information. I was able to anticipate challenges, figure out what was going on, come back to the office, and I was a lot more on the pulse of my organization. Now, what this does as a byproduct, it helps me to make better decisions, but what's the byproduct? What does my team think of me when I'm doing that kind of thing? They have a lot more respect for me. Now, I can tell you there was a time where I got kind of focused on other things, and I wasn't doing that. I wasn't running around with the field team. In fact, I probably wouldn't have seen somebody do a sales presentation in well over a year. And I can tell you that my team probably started to get a sense of, well, you know, Ron's busy doing these training things and he's out doing the seminars and he doesn't really understand what we're going through anymore. The market's changing. And so you start to get that sense. I want my team to believe that, hey, you know what? I know what's happening. I'm on the game and I'm willing to take action for it. So you want to create that. Now, does your team have to like you? The answer is?
No.
No. They have to I hate when they don't, but they have to respect you. They've got to believe that what you're doing is going to create value for the organization. Now, the other thing we find is you've got to exercise business detachment, not play favorites. It's a tough one because some of us get caught up into that. We have people that we like. We have people that we want to spend time with. But the reality is that anytime you spend more time or extend favors or advances or draws or things like that, salespeople talk. You know, they can't hold those secrets, and they start to believe that this person's getting an unequal opportunity. They're getting an unfair advantage. And so I've had to, over the years, be careful of that. Because there are some salespeople that are extremely successful for our group that I just didn't want to spend a lot of time with. And there are some people that were moderately successful, but I liked them. I liked hanging out with them. And what I found was if I spent too much time with any one group, the others started to think, hey, what's going on? So you want to exercise that. You got to make sure. Now, I think it goes without saying that a romantic relationship or an affair within a sales organization is an absolute recipe for failure. If your sales manager is dating one of your salespeople, you've got to end that now. You've got to stop. And that is just, it's just a recipe. And I've had four in my career, not me personally. Too much information. I've had four situations in our organization over the years, last because I've been managing salespeople now since 84, so it's now been 18 years. I've had four times where a manager has got involved with one of the people in the sales force, and the challenge was is they lied about it when confronted, because everybody knew except I guess me, and I'd ask the manager, and they'd say, "Oh no, no way, I wouldn't do that. Come on." You know, they'd give me all the little cliche sayings, which I won't repeat, but they would say, "No, I'm not doing that. I would never do that." And then it bore out to be true. And it made me look bad, it made them look bad, and it rendered them impotent as a leader, and I eventually had to be let go. Now, I think two out of those four were legitimate. I mean, there were two single people. But it's just a recipe for failure. If you ever have that happen, one of them's got to go, or one has to, you know, make a change. Number one is make it a clear policy when you start your company that's just not acceptable behavior, that we can't allow that, so that hopefully the people who, and people fall in love, people are attracted. And if they're, you know, two single, or regardless of the situation, if they do get together, if you set up the parameters correctly up front, hopefully they'll come to you and say, "You know, we didn't intend this for it to happen, but it did, so how should we handle it?" And then you can say, "Well, based on my experience, probably one of you needs to seek your career goal somewhere else, or maybe one of you needs to go back into the sales." Because I think if two people that are in the sales force are dating, that's probably not as big a deal. But when the leader, you know, person who's responsible for the team is seeing one of the other people, there's just no way that the rest of the sales team can think that person's giving them a fair advantage or giving them a fair shot. And so I think if you set it up right up front, but people do, I've had most of them lied. And you know, I mean, I would hear the rumors. People would say, "Hey, Ron, did you know? Did you see?" "No, I didn't." "Wow, I'll get onto that right away." I'd call them into the office. I'd confront the behavior. And they'd say, "Oh, no, no, no." And I'd say, "Well, are you sure?" "No, no, no." And then, you know, you've got to make obviously a judgment there, character judgment. And then in cases, I got duped two or three times. And I had to terminate one gentleman because he lied, and then it actually ended his career with us. And he was a high-level manager. And he denied it, and finally it became just undeniable. And he ended up having to choose to move on somewhere else because of that. I mean, it was a lost opportunity for him. But yeah, it really makes you look bad too if you allow it to go on. Probably to finish that point, be a boss, not a buddy. And it extends obviously to a romantic relationship, but it also extends to just friendly relationships. You've got to make sure. So good leaders are very clear about that. Business is business, personal is personal. And I've had hard lessons to learn, because sometimes we go out and we do the seminars, and we'll go out at night, and you know, we'll have a few drinks, and things can be said. People respond differently when under the influence of any kind of, you know, alcohol, and so you think it's dangerous. It's not a good thing. So you got to keep that kind of that separation. I think it's probably extends to your customer base as well. You know, I mean, that's a tough one. It's something that a lot of companies struggle with, is that their sales team starts to get involved with customer base people too. So, business detachment. The most successful managers I've seen, they keep that separate, and it just works best that way. They've got to develop future vision, constantly selling to their team. This is where the leadership part comes. You've got to paint that picture. I remember reading a book by Victor Kiam. Remember him? Probably don't remember him much. The man who loved the razor, he bought the company. He wrote a book called Going For It. And in his, he talks about a concept called a vista. And you're always painting the vista, which is, you know, where this thing is going. And the best managers I've seen are always kind of painting where is the ultimate picture, because most people aren't real motivated by the day-to-day activity things. And a lot of us as managers, we try to manage day-to-day activity level. Okay, you got to make 100 calls a day. You've got to see this many people a day. You've got to try this many closes a day. And we try to manage that and motivate to that end, but we fail to kind of give them, you know, if you do this, this is where it can be. Now, of course, the key to that is you got to link it to what they want, which is, most managers I know, we'll talk about more later, is they have a real key understanding of what people want in their organization. This other one is kind of an interesting one. I find that they become great listeners. And it's hard sometimes. It is hard because we have so many things going on. I have a particular challenge with it because I was diagnosed a few months ago. I actually have ADD, attention deficit disorder. Never knew I had it as a kid. I never knew I had it as a kid. And some issues came up in my life and personally. And I went through some various counseling. And somebody, you know, after 41 years, somebody said, "Have you ever been diagnosed with ADD?" And I said, "No." And I tell you, in the last 6 months since I've had that question asked of me, I've had major positive changes, I think, in my life, because number one, I'm aware of it, I'm starting to work on it, and it's something that helps me. But for a long time, I could listen to somebody. In fact, if we'd have an interview with one of my sales team, and we'd go to one of those sports bars with the TVs and stuff, I couldn't pay attention because I'm always looking around, and you know, and I was never focused in the meeting. About 1997, I took a sabbatical prior to handling this transaction for Tom Hopkins. Tom was looking for someone to share this management message and help managers implement his training. And so he asked me after seeing what we had done. But prior to that, I went on a 2.5-3 year sabbatical where I basically left my company under the able guidance of a management team, and I went and lived in Oklahoma. And I was the general manager for a company called Sundowner Trailers. Now, if you're familiar with horses, you may have heard of that name. But this is a company that manufactures horse trailers. And I lived in Oklahoma, and I had an office, and I was in charge of about 750 people. When I started, we were about $64 million a year. When I left, we were about $98 million a year. So we did some really neat things that we're going to talk about today that helped grow that. But one of the things that I learned right away is that people in Oklahoma move at a different pace than people in Scottsdale. And so people would come into my office, and have you ever had this happen? They come in, they go, you got a minute? Does that happen to you guys? All the time. So they come in, got a minute. And is it ever a minute?
No.
Never a minute. No. So these people would come in, they'd say, hey, Ron, got a minute? I'd say, sure. And they'd sit down, and then we'd be talking about the weather and the hay prices and the cattle, and, you know, had rain here in a while, and, you know, all this stuff. And then like 30 minutes later, they'd start to talk about what it is that they wanted to talk about. Well, during this whole time, I'm fidgeting. I'm looking at email. I'm trying to see if I got a voicemail message. And, you know, I'm not paying attention to them. And they could tell that I wasn't paying attention to them. So I said, something's got to change. So what I did, I tried an interesting experiment. I actually got it from a seminar I went to. And I got rid of the chairs in the office. And I had the group come in, and they built a countertop around the perimeter of the office. And I created a stand-up office. No chairs. So people would come in. And they'd say, hey, got a minute? I'd say, sure. And I'd turn around from my desk, and I'd say, what's up? And they'd do this. They'd look around, no chairs. And then they would communicate. And what I found within 3 or 4 days was that they would, when standing up, they could communicate directly what they wanted. And there was no discussion of superfluous stuff. And I don't know if there's a kinesthetic, you know, physical connection of standing up allows you to communicate more clearly. But it was a huge time-saving thing for me, and it allowed me to listen better because I knew that they weren't going to stay very long. If you ever have long staff meetings, try this. Pull out all the chairs, get rid of them, and watch how quickly people get through the meetings. They'll come in, they'll look for the chairs. No chairs, they'll get into the agenda. That meeting is very, very succinct, very direct, and very efficient. But as soon as you let people sit down and have a cup of coffee and a donut, man, it just poof, you know, all this stuff just slows down. So try it. I've had really good luck with that. It's helped me focus better. I probably learned it out of adversity, but it's made a huge difference. I also find that when I stand, my phone conversations are more energetic. I found that the first couple of days that I was a little fatigued, but after that, you start to get used to it, and you're actually more energized at the end of the day than if you were sitting all day. I don't get that hunched up stuff going on here with the computer keyboard. I use a headset. And you got to have good shoes, you know, good soles on your shoes, or maybe some insoles type things that are a little more comfortable, maybe nice carpet. But bottom line is you are more efficient when you're moving around, you're more energetic, and the conversations are a lot quicker. So try that. That's an interesting thing I picked up. This is an interesting one, and I'm glad to hear was we asked about what people would do if they were paid to play. They would specialize people in developing people through education. And in all organizations that have success, we find that they make educating others a very important part of what they do. They believe that I want to help other people grow. And they're not so concerned about whether or not people are going to leave or, you know, not take advantage of it. One of the questions we get asked all the time is, hey, Ron, what if we spend all this money to train our people, putting them through your system here, and then they simply just leave? And many companies will not spend training dollars because they have high turnover of salespeople. And then they typically, they'll say, well, what if we spend this money to train, and they leave? And I say, well, better question might be to ask, what if you, you know, don't train them and they stay? That would be even worse. It's funny because people, a lot of times organizations get in this thing called turnover. Have you ever heard the analogy of the person who's in the jungle and there's this river and they're walking through and they're a good Samaritan and they see these people kind of drowning in the river and they start pulling them out? And then all of a sudden they get two people out, or they're exhausted, they save them, mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. And then they look down, there's two more people in there, they got to pull them out, and they're doing all this work trying to pull people out of the river. So busy, so exhausted, that they never take time to go upstream and find out who's throwing them in. And that's what turnover's like. Sometimes we're so busy trying to manage turnover that we don't look at what is the real core. issue and what's providing that sense of turnover. But specialized developed people through education, I think you've got to make that a key part. I would encourage any kinds of educational development programs your companies can provide, any kind of support. I think especially in the areas of automation, I think automation is a key thing. People need to learn how to use computers. There's some great companies out there that teach it. Executrain, New Horizons. There's some great tutorials on CD. There's all kinds of ways to learn. But make sure that your team knows that you're there to support and help them develop to become better in using Office Windows, or Microsoft Windows Office, whatever software programs you use. But automation is key. And it's becoming more and more apparent because sales forces are moving more towards automation. So that's a key part. You want to provide for that. I think any provision you can make to help people type faster, it would be a worthy investment of your company dollar to help people become better typists. And there are programs to do that with, to help people come in better shape. We do something in our group. We're happen to be, and no offense to our fitness club members here, we just happen to be sitting next to what used to be called the Q Club, and now it's 24-hour fitness. Our office happens to sit next to it. But when the Q Club first opened, we made an opportunity for our sales team. We said, listen, if you will commit to working out 8 times a month, we'll pay for half your membership. But if you don't work the 8 times, then you don't get. And we worked out an arrangement with the club and said, if we want to know they're checking in 8 times a month. If they don't, now obviously some people could check in, grab a towel, go to the bathroom and leave. Right? I'm sure some did. But we said if they'll do that, we'll pay half because we want to support that. We know the value of a healthy employee and in corporate wellness. So we would pay for those things. If somebody wanted to pursue education that would help their career, we'd be happy to support that because we believe that we want to help people to become better. One of the things that that we like to believe, and I borrowed this from a local church, and Lainey, you go to over Scottsdale there, come, grow, and go. And we know in our business that people aren't gonna stay with me forever. I wish they would, but many times, especially the people who travel, if it's a high travel position, that's not something somebody's gonna do forever. And unless you've got a corporate structure for them to go. So we used to try to retain people and keep them around, and what we figured out was, you know what, they're not gonna stay with us because there's really not the place to be. And so we changed our philosophy, and we call it now come, join us, grow, and then go. And we believe that if somebody will come and join our organization, learn, and then if they go on to something else, as long as they've left better than they came, we've done a good job. And that's really what we try to do, develop people through education. And we do it in a lot of different ways. Obviously, our business lends itself to that. We also find that you got to look at change as healthy, promote risk-taking. That's a big part of it. You've got to realize that when people make mistakes, they're more educated. Give them second chances. Give them opportunities. Change is a good thing. This is an interesting one because I've heard this many times. I know you have. Praise in public, criticize in. Where did you first hear that? Where did anybody remember where they first heard that saying? Because I know you've heard it before. First was brought to my attention through a book called The 1 Minute Manager by Ken Blanchard. Now, he didn't come up with that, but he popularized it. But it's an old adage. If you have something good to say about somebody, do it as many people as you can gather. If it's something controversial, do it as few people as possible. Had an interesting wake-up call about 4 years ago. I was out riding in the field with one of our top representatives. His name was Dwayne, not the other Dwayne I was talking about, but coincidentally happened to be Dwayne. And we were up in Ventura, California. And there were 2 brand new people that were joining our team, and they were flying in that evening, and then we were gonna have a dinner, and then we had asked Dwayne, our top representative, to kind of coach and mentor these people, kind of a buddy system. So I went in early, I spent the day with Dwayne, riding, watching his appointments. At the end of the day, Dwayne and I talked throughout the day, but we didn't really talk about much, and he didn't say much to me, and he did a good job, he was one of our top people. Then we get to dinner. And we got these 2 brand new people. And we're having a couple drinks, we're having dinner. And about halfway through the dinner, Dwayne kind of reached across the table and says, "Say, Ron, how do you think I did today?" Now, what's Dwayne looking for? Praise. Praise, kudos, in front of these 2 brand new people. And I, of course, said, "Hey, Dwayne, you're awesome. You're the best, man. You did a great job. But you know what, buddy? One of the things I meant to talk to you about is you're getting a little speaker fever." Now, speaker fever doesn't mean much to you guys. But in our business, it's the death knell of a salesperson. Here's how it formulates in your business. You train somebody brand new, and they are learning the presentation. Maybe you even have a flip guide or a residential, or kind of a guide that you go through, a presentation guide. And then about 6 months later, you ride along with them again. After the initial training's over, maybe 6 or 7 months later, you go ride with them again. And you notice that the presentation they're giving on your product is nothing. It resembles nothing like what you asked them to do six. Have you ever seen that happen? It's like they've got this, it's got its own life. It's this, it's all these stories. It's full of stuff. That's what speaker fever is. In our business, if a person kind of gets so far off what the job is, they just want to talk, then becomes, we call it speaker fever. You turn into a speaker, not a salesperson, which is really what you want. There's a huge difference between presentation and persuasion, right? I mean, it's one thing to be a good presenter. Many of us can have great presenters, but a good persuader is a whole different thing. Two great speakers of antiquity, Demosthenes and Cicero. Cicero was a Roman and Demosthenes was a Greek. And when Demosthenes would speak, they'd say, hey, great speech. When Cicero spoke, they said, let's march. Big difference. So Dwayne had this speaker fever, and I said, hey, speaker fever. And he kind of looked at me, didn't say much, nothing was said. Next morning, he comes up to me, says, you know, Ron, I'm your top guy. He says, I bust my butt out here for you. He says, all I wanted was a little bit of stroke in front of these team members because you asked me to kind of take and help them. And he kind of made me look like a goofball. He made me look like a fool. And I just don't appreciate it. I just wanted you to know because you'd want me to tell you that, wouldn't you? Of course, he uses the Hopkins clothes on me, right? And I said, yeah, thanks. And I kind of went, you know what? You're right. I'm sorry. And it was an interesting wake-up call for me because I hadn't really thought about it. But then I started to think, how many times did I assemble a meeting and somebody would come in a little late and I'd do one of these things, you know? You know, tough night last night, or I make a joke. Or I would use sarcasm to pick on somebody in front of the group to try to make a point subtly that I wanted to make because I didn't have the guts to do it one-on-one. And so this was a huge wake-up call for me, and maybe perhaps for you it can be the same, is that if you've ever used humor, sarcasm to kind of beat around the bush to try to make a point, but you did it in front of others, you are perhaps criticizing in public. And so if it's controversial, if it's not something that you would be immensely proud to do it in front of a lot of people, then it needs to be done one-on-one. If it's telling somebody how great of a job they've done, it needs to be with as many people as you can gather, I think, because salespeople love recognition. They thrive on it. Praise in public, criticize in private. This last one is an interesting thing because it's kind of the antithesis of what most of us were raised into in this business. And remember when I said in the beginning, where do most of our salespeople come? We all responded from the sales force. Think about your top performers, maybe yourself, or maybe people that you work with or you're responsible for on your team. When a top performer closes a sale, who closed it? They did. Even if it's a lay down easy sale, the salesperson, the top ego salesperson is going to say, I closed it. Now, if it's a loser sale, if it doesn't happen, if it goes south, is it ever the top salesperson's responsibility? Never. So here's what happens. Top salespeople, by nature, want to accept the credit. What do they want to do with the failure? Delegate it. They want to delegate the blame. It's bad credit, bad customer, loser, our products are too expensive. You know, it's never me. Here's what's interesting. Then you take that person and you make them a manager. And I've yet to see a manager stay successful very long who stands up in front of his team or her team and says, I've turned this division around. Yet that's what top salespeople want to do, is they don't want to say, you've done it. And if it goes south, they say, you know what? I'm the leader. I'm ultimately responsible. If a sports team isn't achieving its objectives in attendance, sales, or winning seasons, who gets let go first? Usually the coach. So the leader has to take the responsibility. You've got to shift that. And most people have a hard time with that. Somebody puts manager on their card, and now they think, okay, you know, I'm arrived, I'm there. And what we find is most managers have a difficult time accepting the failure, but that's what they need to do. The best managers that I've seen, they will, when the success happens, they'll stand up in front of the team and in front of the ownership of the company, and they will give the credit. They will say, the team did it. You know, they were the one. I want to thank the academy, right? They want to give it away. When it fails, they'll take the ownership. Here's the other thing top leaders have to do, is if you are in a position where you report to a board of directors, stockholders, an owner of a company, you've got to fly the flight plan. One of my favorite movies of all time is called 12 O'Clock High with Gregory Peck. And it's the subject of a lot of college courses. I know when I did some Air Force training, they used that as a model of leadership. And one of the things that they constantly went through, that Gregory Peck comes in, has to take over for the bomber squadron in World War II, and he has to take over from this colonel that everybody loved the colonel. But the losses were incredible because, you know, they weren't doing the job, but they love their boss. So he takes over and he starts, you know, giving new orders, but the guy wouldn't fly the flight plan. Basically, he would not do what he kept trying to say, you know, I know that the brass wants us to do this, but let's just do it the way we've always done it. And the losses continued, so eventually he got removed. As a leader, here's what when I took over at Sundowner, when I was the general manager, I reported to John Shipman. He was the owner of the company. And John and I had a real clear understanding in the beginning, because it would have been real easy for me to have to do some things, because there were things that John said, Ron, I need you to do this with the sales force, or I need you to do this with the marketing department. And I didn't agree with it. I'd make my case. I lost my case, because he's the boss. But in the end, who had to fly that flight plan? Now, I had two choices here. I could have said, hey, guys, listen, I think this sucks. This is a terrible idea. But you know the boss. I gotta do the job. Come on, give me a break. Can you guys help me out here? Or I can say, you know what? Here's what we're going to do. And I've looked at all the sides of it, and this is what we're going to do, and I'm excited to help you do this. And I know some of you might have disagreement, but here's the way it's going to play. Now, those two choices. In the beginning, if I say, hey, guys, you know, I'm with you. I wouldn't do it this way, but you know the boss. I'm their friend today, but what's going to happen in 6 months or a year? Eventually, I'm worthless as a leader. And at some point, they're going to say, well, why do we even have him? Because let's go to the boss. So if you want to become a good leader, if you're reporting to others, you got to accept responsibility for the outcome. And in the end, even if you don't agree, you got to fly the flight plan. You got to make it happen. So some key things, nine things. Elaborate on those a little bit. But if you look at those, some of those things, you're probably thinking, yeah, doing them. Good. I'm excited about that. Some of you are saying, ooh, that hit a nerve. That's not something I've been doing real well, but I want to get to work on. But we find that top leaders are doing these things exceptionally well.